Welcome to CUTV News Radio, where our hosts Doug Llewellyn and Jim Masters talk to today's top thinkers from all around the world to bring you information, inspiration, and thought-provoking ideas that you can put to use in your personal or professional life right now. Covering a broad range of topics, we dig deep to discover what makes today's top thinkers tick. CUTV News Radio, it's the show where ideas matter. And now, here's today's host, Doug Llewellyn.
Well, hello, everybody. We welcome you back to Close Up Radio. Nice to have you back with us. We are excited because Lindy Brewster is back with us. She is with OR Consulting. She is the principal of OR Consulting. It's a firm that is definitely breaking a lot of new ground when it comes to leadership, education, and development here in the United States. It's a firm that specializes in leadership development with companies, executive coaching, team development, and culture change. And they do remarkable things. And one thing that is really kind of different here is because Lindy is a very much in-demand coach and a strategist, but she began her career, as we pointed out the last time we spoke, as a clinical psychologist. And she did that before she moved into business management. So she uses both psychology and business while working out matters with leaders and their teams. And she focuses a lot on human behavior, which has always been the underlying factor. Some behaviors will hinder success. Others will drive it. That's one of the things she really focuses on a lot. And she is aware of the behaviors along with emotions that helps causes consequences and helps people connect with others, have a sense of ownership and lead with respect, and also achieve goals collaboratively. So if your people don't have effective behaviors, Lindy notes that the best structure or business strategy sometimes won't work, and that's why. Anyway, to bring you up to date, Lindy worked with OR Consulting in England, then helped establish it here in the United States. It was established here in the United States in 2001 in Reston, Virginia, and she is headquartered in Northern Virginia. Her firm has worked with lots of big companies, but obviously being in Northern Virginia, which is right, you know, the suburbs of Washington, D.C., we talked about, her firm works with a lot of government agencies. So when we broke off the last time we were having our discussion, I was about to ask her if there was much of a difference between working with government agencies and government employees versus commercial firms, and also the length of engagement that might be involved with a government agency versus a commercial firm. So, Lindy, if it's welcome back. Nice to have you back with us again. That's what I was about to ask you when the clock ended on us last time. How about that? Is there a big difference working with government agencies versus commercial firms? How would you answer that?
Well, first of all, hi, Doug, and it's great to be back talking with you again.
Thank you.
In truth, people are people wherever you work with them. So, on the one hand, it's not dissimilar because the team and individual issues are very often underlying. They have the same problems that they're facing. That said, government is different, and we briefly touched on this last week because it's highly regulated, and it's highly regulated for a reason. It's there to protect taxpayers' money to ensure that it's being well spent. So that has an impact on how people can work. If you are constantly being monitored and reviewed, it inevitably has an impact on the speed in which you can work. And I know for people coming into government from the commercial world, that can be very frustrating, the speed at which people work. People in government, I think, are very aware of that. And certainly the teams that I work with often spend time thinking about how they can speed up what they do within the constraints that they work within. Some of the other key differences between government and commercial world, of course, is the profit, non-profit focus. And one of the things I often see when I'm working with contractors and government together is one of the tensions there is exactly that, because a government contractor works for the government, but they also have owners who, certainly in terms of the big companies, are traded on stock markets, so they have to have a profit focus as well. There's a the reason for the profit focus, of course, is not just to return profits to their owners, but to return profits that can then be invested so they can do the research that then provides the government with really up-to-date and cutting-edge science or support that they really need. The people who work in the government are very dedicated. They're usually really, really highly motivated people who have a view to service. That's what they see their lives as being. And for many people in government, the whole profit motive is very distasteful. And so one of the things I often find myself doing is helping both sides understand the other side's perspectives and not get dug into perceptual biases about what's right or wrong, but to look at what they both need to do to be able to support each other and create an effective partnership. So the dedication you see in government, it isn't that it isn't there in the commercial world. It very often is there. But I think it's something that's very noticeable when you work with government employees.
That's very interesting. In other words, the bottom line, the profit margin at the end of the day, is not the most critical thing to these government agencies or employees. That's what I'm gathering. Is that kind of right?
That's absolutely right. I mean, in their own work, well, of course, profit is just
yeah.
not a thought that's there. When they are negotiating with companies, because of the pressures they have on them in terms of managing taxpayers' money, they are constantly pressing for best possible pricing, which makes absolute sense. However,
right.
one of the tensions between the contracting world and the government world, and this causes conflict between individuals. I mean, things like this get very personalized. One of the biggest tensions is the fact that they often don't really understand the constraints the commercial company is under. And it's not just about profit, it's actual cost of buying materials. And most of these big contractors have many, many suppliers who also have to make a living. The government, because of the lack of government workers, because of often the lack of focus on that or lack of understanding of that, will demand pricing that actually will leave the suppliers in a place where they're sometimes actually making a loss. I mean, they're not even breaking even because you get the dedication to service. That then starts to cause problems because the last thing that people who are contracting for the government want are that the suppliers go out of business because then they don't have what they need to conduct whatever it is that they need to do, be it running armored vehicles or providing services that do all sorts of different things around the world. So that's clearly a tension that's there.
Well, you know, it's interesting about your firm. I'm amazed at what you do and how you do it. And I'm really interested in the fact that you come from a clinical psychologist point of view, which adds a whole different aspect to the way you work with companies. As I understand it, you work with behavior and relationships. You really focus on that. It may seem like intangible elements to other firms and are hard to measure. So how do you assess return on investment? That's another term you hear a lot in corporations, maybe not government agencies, but you know, the corporate world and the commercial world, ROI, return on investment, is very important.
Mm-hmm.
How about that?
Yeah.
How do you assess your return on investment? Talk about that for a moment.
So first of all, I am focused on psychology. However, it's always with the business objectives in mind. And because of my background in business and the research work that I did in critical management, I work with organizations and teams that goes on a trajectory from initial relationships, team dynamics, all the way through to strategic implementation. So there's a curve from behavior to business. Now, that has an impact on how I and my clients with me will assess the return on investment. At the lowest level of return on investment, if you have a team or a business where the interrelationships are so poor they're impacting the business. Very often what a company will want to know is, after an initial intervention, are there any changes in behavior? And they'll take feedback from the people that attended the work that we've done, through to over a short period of time monitoring to see if there's been any behavioral change that's going to start to fix the issues that they've got. As I work over time with people, then what becomes more important is being able to relate the work that we do to the actual business return on investment. And the way that we do that is that as we progress from behaviors and interrelationships and team dynamics through to focus on short-term and longer-term business objectives, in the work that I do, we're often constructing those objectives or doing specific work around those objectives in the meetings that I'm facilitating. The behavioral bit comes in that, where we then start to interlink the how are you doing against your objectives to and how were you working together, how did you engage the people, and so we make sure that we record everything that we do and are able then to relate it directly to the outcomes of the business, and that might be some way down the line. So, for example, this week I've been working with an organization where we've been doing the looking at what are called objectives and key results for this coming year and into 2021, and linking that to their strategy and general direction. And we got very specific around the business outcomes and what they need to do to achieve those. We've recorded those. And as I say, as we're working, we're also talking about how they're going to work together, because this is a business that's a matrixed organization, and every business owner in the business has to rely on teams that are made up of people that don't report to them. Now, that means that they have to rely on their colleagues to support them in holding their people accountable and also making sure they have the resource to deliver those outcomes. That means you have to have good relationships, good communications. When there is a conflict, you have to have a way of managing that conflict that's effective. So that's how the two interlink and how I look at ROIs. So base level, it's feedback immediately after a piece of work. For longer term engagement, it's related directly to the outcomes of the business so that I know that I'm delivering them a good return on investment, and they know that as well. That's one of the reasons people come back to me consistently for work, because they know that I'm going to do that with them and it's going to have a direct impact on the bottom line.
That's very good. When you say record them, when you say that, what do you mean by record them? Are you doing video, audio, and how do you use the recordings? But explain that.
No, it's written recording. So I use photography to capture what we do. In a workshop, I actually use no high tech, or very rarely use high tech. If I'm doing a conference, I'll probably use video and projection and things like that. We might do electronic voting. But in most of the work I do, there is no technology in the room. We simply use either whiteboards or flip chart paper. And the reason for that is that actually you can be much more agile with the low-end technology than you can with the high-end technology, because people get wrapped around trying to create fancy PowerPoints as opposed to doing the thinking that they need to do. So when I talk about recording from the work that we're doing, we capture most of it in writing. The recording of the work is then we take photographs of what we've done, and or people actually take the physical artifacts out of the workshop, and we'll have people then work on those to produce recording methods within their own company, depending on the technology they have, so that they can go into companies' systems to then be monitored over the period of the year to check that results are being achieved.
Well, that's good. It was worth asking the question. I want to point out, we're talking with Lindy Brewster. She's one of the principals of OR Consulting. I haven't mentioned it, but she is on the Forbes Coaches Council. She's an associate fellow of the British Psychological Society, and she's a member of the James Madison University Summit Series and has often been published by authorities that address the subjects of teamwork and industry. One of the things that OR Consulting really focuses on, you have four key areas, but leadership development is one of them. Talk a little bit about that aspect of leadership development. You're working with the top leaders of the company. How high up the ladder do you go with leadership development?
Right up to CEO level. When we talk about leadership development, we're actually talking about programs of learning which have a specific set framework. I'll call it a framework rather than an agenda. We develop the leadership development programs along with our clients so that it best meets their needs. But we usually come in with this framework of what's going to make sense in terms of both theoretical and practical input to support the organization. And so, I'll give you an example of one leadership development program that we ran for a period of almost 10 years with one of the big defense aerospace organizations. And at the time, they had come together made up of multiple small companies. They didn't have a company culture, and they wanted a leadership development program to do two things. One is to start creating the basis of leaders in their organization so that they knew that they would be able to successfully grow. But secondly, to create an organization culture through values and behaviors that would then help to pull these disparate groups together. It started with the CEO and their team and their reports, and it was a program of learning that covered managing change, covered effective behaviors and communications, and covered things like how to be assertive without being aggressive, how to manage and indeed encourage constructive conflict, because that's what creates a high performance team. And over the 10 years we covered well over 3,000 to 4,000 leaders in the organization who went through it. The top team continuously was involved, and when new members of the top team came in, they would come to the program. By the time we'd finished, we'd covered from the top team down to the newly just above supervisor level leaders. So that's the kind of span that we cover in the leadership development programs.
That's pretty impressive. That was a long engagement. That sounds like it's a rather extraordinary engagement. You were engaged with them for a number of years, but obviously it worked. Do you think it made a huge difference in that firm and the outcome of that firm and on their bottom line?
So the company was one that had, as I say, come together from smaller companies. It was actually started life as a British-owned defense business, but the American organization was established and runs as a separate business. The business internationally is huge. The American business, over the period that we did that leadership development program, and clearly the leadership development program wasn't the cause of this. However, people said that it supported them to be able to lead the company to do this. It was one of the things, one of the many things that helped them. They started life as a $1.5-ish billion organization here in the States. And by the time we'd finished working with them, through both organic growth and acquisition, they had grown to just under $20 billion.
Wow. That's very impressive. Very impressive. Well, good for you. Obviously, your input did have some effect on that, if not a lot of impact on it. No question about it. Coaching, that's another big development. One of the things you work on, as we mentioned, you do leadership development, you do coaching, team development, culture change. You refer to that a little bit. What about coaching? How does that? How do you work with coaching in that area?
So there's two forms of coaching for me. One is individual coaching, and one is what I'd call team coaching, which is the team development work. For individual coaching, it's very much constructed to meet the individual's needs. So I would typically, when somebody asks for coaching, spend time with them scoping out what it is that they want to get from coaching, how long that they want to be involved for, meaning I would typically suggest 6 months if you're going to have significant change. But there are some people that know that they've got to work on things and they've got to work on it rapidly. So we'll say, no, I don't want to meet monthly. I want to meet weekly, and I want to do that for a month or two because I need rapid change here. But each coaching engagement is different because it's about the individual's needs. And you know, some coaching engagements will go on for years because we move from a place where the person is in need of significant leadership development, where they want to talk through behaviors, what a leader does, how they engage their people, all those kind of things, through to a place where we will have intermittent coaching engagements, usually when they want to spend time reflecting, either because they want to drive some change or something isn't going quite right with their organization, or they're under some kind of pressure. And that coaching engagement will be very different. It's not so much learning. It's a shared reflection where I might bring in some theoretical frameworks to help them think, but often I'm just there to listen and to, when I say listen, I mean actively listen. So rather as you're doing today with me, I'll spend time framing up questions that will help them think through what they're doing, to just being a sounding board for them, where they just simply want to vent over something that's happened, and the relationship that I have with them is so long and so good that that's okay, because I'm an outside agency that is going to hold whatever they've said confidentially, and there's nobody else that they can go to. So does that explain coaching? Would you like a little bit more information?
No, it does, and I'm learning, you know, because I understand from your company's approach or consulting approach, you work on coaching, you work on developing leadership capabilities that someone may be newly installed in a leadership position and don't feel that they're quite ready for it, but they're in the job. You help support transitions for the different positions in the company, and then help people if they're involved in some sort of conflict or performance challenge within an organization. There are a lot of different areas that you focus on in the role of coaches. At least that's what I gather. Am I right?
Absolutely, exactly right. It's exactly that. Yes, and as I say, it's very individually focused. That's what makes the coaching meaningful. It's not just something that we pull off a shelf and say, here's our coaching process. We have a process, but it's not one that focuses on content, and we adapt it according to the leader's needs.
Let me ask you another thing. I point out you are a member of the Forbes Coaches Council. You know, a lot of people may not understand what that means. I mean, it's a real credit to you to be a member of that. But explain the importance of that. What is the Forbes Coaches Council? How do you describe it?
Okay. So, I mean, I think everybody probably knows Forbes magazine. They have a number of different councils with specific theoretical backgrounds to them. And the Coaches Council is one of those. Membership of the council is by invitation only. So you get approached by Forbes to become part of the Coaches Council, and they will interview you, and they will ask for evidence of what they think that they've already seen before they appoint you to that. What the Coaches Council is for is two things. First of all, it's a networking support for the high-level coaches themselves. So there are forums and places where the coaches who belong to the Coaches Council can support each other, from everything from how do you go about pricing this kind of intervention through to specific questions around issues that are being faced, and people join in and support each other. The other really important part of the Coaches Council is that it's open for anybody to go and look into, and what you will find there are regular expert panels that address specific issues, and there is encouragement to write and contribute articles, of which I've done a number over the last year, and we'll be doing a series this year. The first one is just about to go into publication for this year. So that's the importance of the Coaches Council. It's a body that informs.
And also, we really haven't pointed out a lot about your background before you actually came here. I know you worked with OR Consulting in England. What was your background before you got involved with them?
I was a clinical psychologist in the health services, and then I transitioned into management in the health services, the National Health Service in the UK, and that's where I got some of the basic management training. I did my first couple of certifications in management while I did that, and then I'd moved completely away from psychology. I ended up on an executive team of what's called a health service trust, which is in effect a health service business in the UK, where I was responsible for the strategy, business planning, risk management, and the capital management of the company, which meant that I was responsible for project managing some hospital bills, which was fascinating and completely different to psychology. And at that point, I decided I wanted to move on. I thought I wanted to be promoted within the health services, eventually becoming a CEO. And as I went for interviews, and I would usually, when I applied, reach the final interview. And a couple of times when I did that, I walked out thinking, I'm not excited about this. It's not what I want to do. And, you know, you radiate that in an interview. So sure enough, I didn't get the positions. So I went
okay.
to KPMG. I went to KPMG for some personal coaching, career coaching. And the coach there said, you do know that psychology is still important to you, don't you? And we started looking at positions that might merge those two together. And that's how I came to join what's called Organization Resource in the UK.
That's remarkable. What a great story. I have to ask you, if you knew you weren't going to be happy in the position, you know, you were interviewing for, how about now? Do you love this work and what you're doing? Obviously, you bring something really special to it. Do you like it?
Well, I've been doing it now for, it will be 23 years this summer. And I think you can hear from the way I talk about it. I really enjoy it. I really enjoy working with teams. I really enjoy seeing people change. I can see that I make a difference. I think the struggle in the health service was sometimes it was difficult to see that you could make a difference, and that's really important to me. So, yes,
you know,
I'm working with people all the time.
That's so great to be able to say you're making a difference. That's the one thing I know about companies all over the best places to work are the places where people who work there feel like they're making a difference and they're contributing. Obviously, you're part of that team. It's what a great picture. We've been talking to Lindy Brewster. She's one of the principals of OR Consulting, headquartered in Ruston, Virginia. The firm's website, by the way, fascinating information about the firm, orconsulting.us.com. Lindy, thanks so much. You'll be back again next week, and we'll talk to Lindy more next week. Take care, Lindy. Have a good week, okay?
You take care, too.
Okay, bye for now.
Bye.
You've been listening to CUTV News Radio. If you want to learn more about our programming or perhaps be considered for a future show, visit us on the web at www.cutvnews.com. And if you enjoyed listening to today's show, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, and be sure to write a review. Thanks for listening, and from all of us at CUTV News Radio, we hope you have a productive and inspired day.
Okay, everybody, I'm Doug Llewellyn. That'll do it for this edition of CUTV News Radio, or Close-Up Radio, as we call it. We'll see you next time. Till then, take care, and bye for now.